and welcome to this week's edition of The Talking Newspaper. This is, of course, for the area covered by St Albans, Harpenden, and all those delightful and charming villages and other communities within the area. This is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday the 20th of January, 2018. I'm Rob Pierman, and this week I chose one of our friend Goffby's music tracks called Falling Snow. Now, it's obvious why I chose it. There's been quite a lot of it about this week. Whether you think the piece actually sounds like snowflakes falling, well, that's a matter for each of us to decide. Now, we'll be on to our news stories from this week's local papers very shortly, and they'll be followed by this week's suggestions for programmes on national radio that might interest you. And I'm very grateful to Sue for providing these suggestions. This is her first week on the job, and I think she's chosen very well. After a few more falling snowflakes, I'll be back with a reader whose voice you know very well. We'll be discussing one of Charles Dickens' great novels, A Tale of Two Cities. And then after a little bit more music, in part three, I'm looking with Akhtar Zaman, the president of the local Islamic Centre, at another of the pillars of Islam. This time, it's the Hajj, or pilgrimage, something I've always wanted to understand. In the studio today, I'm being helped by Alex and Bill, and of course, as usual, by Sue and Richard.
Hello, this is Lucy here, and we begin with a story about new leads in a 60-year-old murder case after an appeal. Anne Noblett's body was discovered in woodland near Whitwell on January the 31st, 1958, by dog walkers, a month after she'd gone missing. She'd last been seen on December the 30th, 1957, when she was returning home to Wheathampstead after attending a dance class with friends in Harpenden. The 17-year-old had taken a bus home and got off at Cherry Tree Corner. It was the last time she was seen alive. Anne was strangled, police believe, within hours of her disappearance. Due to the condition of the body when it was found, police believe her body was held in cold storage before being moved to dense woodland in Rose Grove Woods, known locally as Young's Wood, in Horn Hill, Whitwell. At the time, extensive searches were carried out involving hundreds of police officers, police dogs, the military and members of the public who volunteered to help. A number of people were questioned by officers, but nobody was ever charged. Officers from the Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Major Crime Unit are still trying to find out what happened. Detectives have reviewed her case a number of times, and a special 60th anniversary appeal by detectives for information in December has now led to several people coming forward with possible leads. A spokesman for Hearts Police said, "We've been contacted by six people following the anniversary appeal, and at this stage, our inquiries are ongoing to fully explore the information they have to share." Anne's younger brother, Hugh, is still deeply affected by her death, and while police admit there is the possibility that Anne's killer has died, Mick Flavin from the Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Investigation Review Team says an unsolved murder case is never closed.
Hello, this is Hilary. The NHS Trust responsible for St Albans City Hospital has still not managed to meet monthly targets for accident and emergency admissions and planned operations. West Hearts Hospital NHS Trust, which manages St Albans City, Hemel Hempstead and Watford Hospitals, has not hit the target for A&E since May 2015. In December, WHHT treated or admitted 77.4% of patients to Watford A&E, whereas the national target is 95%, and the average for trusts in England is 85%. 88.3% of patients in WHHT's care waited less than 18 weeks for planned operations or care, whereas the national target is 92%, and England's average is 89.5%. The Trust last met the planned operations and care target in November 2015. However, it beat the target for cancer care, with 87.8% of patients beginning treatment within 62 days of urgent GP referral. The national target is 85%, and the average for England is 82.5%. Health Watch Hertfordshire's Paul Regan said, "When talking about WHHT's A&E results, it's vital to look at national trends. In December, 3 out of 133 trusts managed to hit their A&E targets. this is not an issue unique to West Hearts, or one that has an easy or obvious solution. This increase in demand has also led to a knock-on effect on planned care as resources continue to be stretched. Hospital results should be viewed as a whole. Though no one should have to wait longer than expected for an operation, the recent CQC inspection results show WHHT are making year-on-year improvements. Health Watch Hertfordshire, along with other groups and agencies, has worked with the Trust, and it's wonderful to see that this month they have been taken out of special measures. The CQC inspection found WHHT, which manages hospitals in St Albans, Watford and Hemel Hempstead, still required improvement, but the surgery team at St Albans was rated good across all five criteria: safety, leadership, effectiveness, caring and responsiveness. A WHHT spokesperson said, "Winter is always a challenge for hospitals, and this year is no different. If anything, it's even busier. We had the highest number of attendances on record for the month of December, with 8,234 people arriving at Watford General Hospital's A&E department. Accidents and illnesses occur on any day of the calendar year, including bank holidays, when other parts of the health service are closed or are running with reduced staff, such as Christmas and Boxing Day. Despite the emergency department being exceptionally busy, we continue to get some very heartwarming praise in the form of letters or on social media. We are implementing a range of measures to help us improve waiting times for patients. Additional consultants and a nurse consultant have been appointed. There has also been a recent expansion into the space previously used by physiotherapy, providing extra assessment space. Also, a new way of working has been adopted, which means that patients are assessed and treated sooner, and that their pain relief and hydration are monitored more closely. Together, these measures are helping to make being treated in our emergency department a much more positive experience. We have submitted a business case for funding to create a new and enlarged emergency department and also redevelop the site of St Albans and increase the activity levels there, particularly surgery. WHHT was compared against England's 135 trusts.
Hello, this is Penny. Town proves resistant to call for greenbelt homes. No homes should be built on Harpenden's greenbelt sites to help accommodate some of the 15,000 new houses needed in the district, say campaigners. There is provision for 128 new homes in the Harpenden Neighbourhood Plan, NP, a blueprint for future planning guidelines and infrastructural policies. But St Albans District Council's recently published local plan, LP, announces its intention to build 15,000 homes across the district from 2020 to 2036. Although SADC's proposal pinpoints 8 green belt settlements for 6,500 homes and provision for 5,000 houses on brownfield sites, it still needs to find room for 3,000 new builds on the Greenbelt. Harpenden Town Council, HTC, cannot release Greenbelt sites for building, but any pieces of land offered by HTC would have been considered by SADC to lighten the load. However, no extra Greenbelt sites were suggested in the neighbourhood plan. HT said it chose not to submit any Greenbelt land because it wanted to wait for St Albans LP plans to be more concrete. Chairman of the Harpenden Greenbelt Association, David Rankin, said he believes the town is at full capacity and extra cars on the road alone will bring Harpenden to a grinding halt. If 500 houses are built on northwest Harpenden and 770 on northeast Harpenden, that is 2,540 cars at 2 per household. If you add in the growth within Harpenden and thus within the Greenbelt, which is proceeding apace, add on another, say, 800 homes to give a grand total of 2,070 new homes. He asked, where would even 10% of 4,140 cars park? David said SADC's Greenbelt review was flawed. The scoring of Greenbelt sites by SADC has been one long exercise in declining what result is politically required and adjusting the scores as necessary to achieve that result. Planning portfolio holder at SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, worked on the NP before she moved into her current role, working on the LP. They haven't looked at the Greenbelt in Harpenden, and there's a surprising amount of Greenbelt in Harpenden. It's actually all around one side, and they have the power, if they wished, to identify Greenbelt sites. She added, I think there's a fear that if they identify sites, then there will be more building. But the NP cannot be used to prevent development, and everybody is aware of that. I know that work has been done on how people can be allowed to build, what houses would look like, what should be businesses and what should be domestic, and partly that was to protect the high street from development. A spokesman from HTC said, having taken advice from our planning consultant and national experts, the Neighbourhood Plan Steering Group decided not to recommend sites in the Greenbelt. The reason for this is that there is no guarantee on when the local plan will be adopted, and so there could be a considerable time gap between the adoption of each document, during which the favourability and deliverability of allocated sites could change. The Harpenden NP recognises that new development in the Greenbelt may be approved by SADC and so has looked at contingency measures. These are in the form of infrastructure policies that will aim to reduce any impact on communities. The Harpenden Neighbourhood Plan will soon be presented to the steering group for approval.
Hello, this is Sarah. Urgent action demanded after smog levels in the district reach worrying new heights. Choking levels of air pollution in St Albans have now reached alarming new heights, campaigners have revealed. Toxic fumes are more than 2.5 times the legal limit, according to St Albans Green Party. The legal limit for nitrogen dioxide levels is 40 micrograms cubed, and campaigners previously measured levels of 67 and 87, which refers to the number of micrograms per cubic metre of air. However, in their most recent test, campaigners found nitrogen dioxide levels on Hollywell Hill and in Sumpter Yard were at 105. Air quality expert and green campaigner Keith Cotton said, "The risks for people's health are serious, especially for young children and many others who are particularly vulnerable. The district and county councils have a duty to act, and act fast, to protect our health. Air pollution is one of the biggest threats to public health. We did this testing off our own bat to shine a light on the urgent need for action by St Albans District and Herts County Councils. Even inside the car, pollution levels from atmospheric fumes can be dangerous. It's in everyone's interest that we take steps to keep heavily polluting vehicles out of our city, ease congestion, and make it more attractive for people to walk or cycle. Air pollution in the UK causes 40,000 premature deaths a year. In St Albans, that equates to around 100 deaths as a proportion of that overall figure, based on St Albans' population. This is a serious public health issue for our city." The results were retested by a laboratory and found to be correct. The party also measured 56 micrograms cubed outside St Albans City School on Hatfield Road and 56 outside Pound World. St Albans Council's Head of Community Services, Joe Tavernier, said, "Improving air quality across the district is a council priority and we've undertaken a considerable amount of work on this. Most air pollution is caused by emissions from vehicles and our ability to reduce those is limited, so we work in partnership with a number of organisations, including Herts County Council, bus companies, local taxi drivers and central government. As part of this commitment, we monitor nitrogen oxide levels at around 40 sites across the district. Our annual air status report, compiled by an independent expert for 2016, did not indicate any concentrations above the EU and national annual average limit. That's a substantial improvement on 2008, when there were 11 sites above that limit. Measuring concentration is a complex and technical task that must follow government guidelines. For instance, for the assessment to be meaningful, measurements have to be taken regularly over 12 months rather than at one moment of time.
Since the parliamentary expenses scandal of 2009, MPs' claims from the public purse have come under greater scrutiny. So how much has your MP been claiming back on expenses, and how are they using your money? Figures released by the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority last week show how much MPs who earn a basic annual salary of £76,011 have claimed since April last year. The figures reveal that Hitchin and Harpenden MP Bim Afolami has claimed £2,000 in expenses for subscription to the Conservative Backbench European Research Group, which gathers research and lobbies for Brexit. Mr. Afolami, who was elected last June, backed Remain in the European Union membership referendum 2 years ago. He told this paper, "My position has not changed. This particular cost is for legislative advice, research and detailed statistical information relating to my parliamentary work." Several neighbouring MPs claim upwards of £2,600 each to pay for the not-for-profit policy research unit, which pools researchers between Conservative MPs with the aim of saving money and duplication of work. Mr. Afolami and North East Hearts MP Sir Oliver Heald have both claimed the council tax on their constituency homes back on expenses at a cost of £3,774.26 between them. The Hitchin and Harpenden MP also claims £1,800 a month for accommodation in London. Mr. Afolami said, "All my costs associated with being an MP are in full accordance with the reformed IPSA guidelines, which are publicly available on the IPSA website." The full figures for MPs in and around our area are as follows. Bim Afolami, Conservative, Hitchin and Harpenden, £15,014.80, including office costs, £4,419.20, including stationery, £579.69, constituency office telephone usage and rental, £182, other equipment, £30.03, internet usage and rental, £137.48, website design and production, £740, European Research Group subscription, £2,000, and computer software, £750. Accommodation, £9,970.20, including £2,369.77 for council tax and £400.43 for other fuel at his constituency home, and £7,200 for rent on London accommodation. Travel, £625.40, including £324 for his own travel by car, £97.30 for rail journeys, £24.10 for staff rail journey, and £180 for dependents travel by car. Anne Main, Conservative, St Albans, office costs £6,019.65, including stationery, £363.49, constituency office rent, £2,076.16. Policy research unit subscription, £2,680. And computer software, £900. Staffing, £640, all to constituency staff.
Now, this is the Hearts Ad comment on the story that you've just heard. The many thousands of commuters who travel into London daily on the beleaguered Thameslink line will probably be spitting out their overpriced coffees at this week's report on MPs' expenses. For instead of joining his constituents in suffering the trauma of this rail route, Harpenden Representative Bim Afolami is renting a property in the capital at taxpayers' expense. This accommodation is costing you £1,800 a month. And on top of that total, he's also claiming a refund on the £2,369.77 he pays in council tax at his constituency home in Hitchin. It's not as if MPs work long hours anymore either, with the Commons sitting from 2:30 till 10:30 on Mondays and 11:30 till 7:30 on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. On Thursdays, they work from 9:30am to 5:30pm, and Fridays from 9:30am to 3pm. Do those hours really justify the £7,200 rent paid on his London pad since last April, when he lives so close to Westminster? Of course, there's no question that Mr. Afolami is actually doing anything illegal here. He's following the reformed Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority guidelines for MPs' costs, as established following the expenses scandal of 2009, which includes provision for renting a London home. However, there's a big difference between those MPs based hundreds of miles away who cannot make a daily commute between their constituency and Parliament, and one who can hop on a train which will get him into London in less than half an hour. This newspaper gave Mr. Afolami the opportunity to explain why he felt the need to claim for a second property, but he declined, instead offering a bland statement which basically said he was doing nothing wrong. Perhaps he should have spoken to his neighbour Anne Main, who also insisted she wasn't doing anything wrong when she claimed rent on a second property in St Albans back in 2009. But Mrs Main came under fire when it was revealed her daughter was living in the flat rent-free. She's been particularly frugal in the years since the scandal and would have been ideally placed to offer some advice to newly elected Mr Afolami about the ethical implications of his expenses claim. He might have followed the rules, but there is certainly an ethical question over his actions. Why should his constituents be forced to endure soaring season ticket costs, late trains and cancelled services, while also paying for him to enjoy the luxury of a London pad and subsidising his council tax at home? As MP for Hitchin and Harpenden, Mr Afolami should be setting an example and standing shoulder to shoulder with his constituents through their daily hardships. How can he be expected to fight on their behalf over the Thameslink service when he kips in the capital instead of experiencing its problems? Mr Afolami has all the makings of being a great politician, maybe even a future PM, but he needs to consider how his actions might be perceived by his electorate instead of merely claiming to be following the rules.
Nascot Lawn Battle heads to High Court next month. Families have been granted permission to challenge the closure of Nascot Lawn in the High Court. Last Friday, Mr Justice Dove granted permission to the families following the decision by Harts Valley's Clinical Commissioning Group, HVCCG, in November to defund the Children's Respite Centre. Mr Justice Dove said, "I am satisfied this claim is properly arguable on all grounds. Clearly, for the reasons which have been set out by the claimant, this claim should be expedited for the earliest possible hearing date. This case must be heard as soon as possible. Parents of the disabled children who attend the Watford Centre were shocked in June when HVCCG announced plans to withdraw its £660,000 of funding. Since then, they have fought to keep the service open, and in September, HVCCG agreed to continue the funding and to consult further within the affected families. However, in November, they decided to permanently stop the funding, so the families resumed legal proceedings, as without the money, the centre will likely close. Parent and campaigner Satnam Kaur said, "It goes without saying we are all extremely happy the judge has seen the arguable case and understands the urgency. Most of the Nascot families have now had their only and last one night of respite for January. No others have been scheduled yet. The strain we're being placed under is immense." Alex Rook, a A partner at Irwin Mitchell, representing the families, said, "Families have been left with no alternative but to issue court proceedings once again. We would again urge HVCCG to reconsider its decision and enter into constructive dialogue, bringing to an end the anger, frustration and uncertainty families feel. The closure of Nascot Lawn would have a devastating effect on the community." Chief Executive of HVCCG, Catherine Magson, said, "We will of course participate fully in this legal process. We made our position clear following the funding decision by our Finance and Performance Committee in November 27, after extensive consultation with the families. In light of the legal proceedings, we would not want to comment further at this time."
City centre buskers will be subject to stricter rules if a draft code of practice is approved. St Albans District Council, SADC, will soon be consulting on new street performance code after officers in the city centre complained about noise disturbance. Businesses said staff members could not answer calls or work efficiently because instruments were so deafening. If the draft code is approved, it would be forbidden to play music that can be heard more than 30 metres away, stay in one area for more than an hour, return to the same spot twice on the same day, clog up the pavements and sit on a public bench. Musicians would also not be allowed to use amplification drums, trumpets or other loud instruments. They would be required to take regular breaks and turn down the music if requested by an authorised officer. It's noticed that soliciting contributions would be regarded as begging and could result in prosecution. Donations for CD handouts should not be compulsory. If they are, a separate street trading consent licence is required. The report says complaints about busking tend to apply on a small number of performances and usually relate to noise levels, repetitive performances or obstruction. As a busker, you should consider your intended performance and location carefully to avoid complaints. You should avoid repeating the same tune or song for the entire performance and be considerate with the volume that you use. It stresses that even if the code of practice is adopted, instruments would not be confiscated and legal notices not handed out unless buskers are causing a disturbance. The Keeping Streets Live campaign and a musicians union will be approached in a consultation. SADC's Licensing and Regulatory Committee will consider and potentially amend the draft rules on January 23rd, before the consultation starts. There's already a bylaw in place for busking in St Albans, but this code is much more comprehensive. Various other towns and cities in Britain implement a busking code because the practice is not regulated outside of London, where in some places buskers require a licence.
A charity shop has been left devastated by an unexplained fire which tore through the building and forced the closure of a major road. The Dogs Trust shop in Station Road, Harpenden, was the scene of a major blaze at around 5:40pm on January the 10th. Two fire engines from Harpenden, one from St Albans and one from Wheat Hampstead, rushed to tackle the inferno, and crews used hose reels to battle the inferno for about 2 hours. Firefighters thanked a kind-hearted chef from nearby Italian restaurant Graffiti, who supplied them with free pizza and drinks while they worked. Owner, Neil Orser, had been waiting for a doctor's appointment when he got a call from his wife to say Station Road was closed and somewhere along the strip was up in flames. Just in case it was Graffiti, Neil sprinted back to the restaurant. "I said, 'I'm really sorry, I've got to go,' and legged it out." He saw the fire at Dogs Trust. The whole shop was gutted. "I can't believe what happened. Fire is a nasty thing. I can't work out what's gone on. The fire was horrendous. It was crazy and the whole road was closed. There were fire engines and police everywhere. I went out the back and the firefighters were talking and I said I'd bring them water. And then I said, 'Are you hungry?' And they said, 'Yeah.'" Some of the firefighters remembered coming to help Neil 25 years ago when an electric meter in the eatery caught a light. After word of the altruism got out, members of the Harpenden community took to Facebook to thank Neil for his generosity. It is not known how much stock was lost in the fire, but pictures show significant damage both inside and outside the building. A spokeswoman from Dogs Trust said, "Thankfully, no one was in the shop at the time, and those in the flats above are safe and sound. We're helping the emergency services to establish the cause of the fire and are unable to comment further at this time. The shop was a thriving part of the community and we'd like to thank all our volunteers and supporters in Harpenden for their help. We'll do our best to reopen as quickly as possible once it's safe to do so. The charity said other shops can take in donations while the Harpenden store gets back on its feet.
Volunteers are working on plans to demolish and rebuild the Fleetville Community Centre. They want to modernise and strengthen the Royal Road Centre, which was originally built in the 1940s and has been running as a community centre since 1982. If it doesn't fall down around our ears before then, trustee and leader of the project Mike Neighbour said, we want to erect a new building that's fit for purpose, either on our own or in partnership with another organisation. The building is currently owned by St Albans Council, and the trustees intend to apply for ownership of the building in the first half of this year. In 1939, tunnels were dug under the neighbouring recreation ground to use as emergency shelters, with a concrete cap placed on top of the tunnels. The centre was built on top of this cap, meaning it has no foundations of its own, and was used as a nursery for mothers working at the nearby Belito site. Mr Neighbour said it was not expected to have a permanent life, probably about 10 years. It's done 70. We have done as much as we can to the building as we are required to do, replacing all the windows and doors and emergency exits. And the heating is no longer open coke fires, but the building bleeds heat and the roof is too low due to it having been a nursery. It's a labour of love. We have moved walls, improved floors, and local tradespeople have chipped in by giving us pots of paint or selling us materials at less than the cost price. Mr Neighbour and other volunteers are currently looking at a range of options, but first want to gain ownership of the building. The project is creating mixed feelings for some, including Caroline Brooke, whose children used to attend a group at the centre. She said, "What's lovely is it's used by lots of different groups. There's a group of people with learning difficulties and two different playgroups. I love that old building because it's distinctive, but it's hopeless. They could carry on in there, but that would be silly. So as much as I'll miss it, I do think it needs to be replaced."
Dismay at privatisation of physiotherapy service. A cardiac support group, which supports residents with heart disease, has said it's dismayed by the privatisation of physiotherapy services. Heartbeats provides advice and support to cardiac patients and their families in St Albans and Harpenden, and has fought to be allowed to continue to use the gym at St Albans City Hospital for 4 exercise classes a week. The classes, which help patients exercise after surgery, are held in the hospital's Maple unit. Hearts Valley CCG, Clinical Commissioning Group, has now given a contract for providing this service to private company Connect Health. Heartbeats chairman Brian York said the concern of Heartbeats members is over another privatisation of a service which they use. "Our concern is not about physio within the cardiac rehab service, but the general physio service, which many use. Heartbeats exercise classes are taken by physiotherapists, and the clear vibes we pick up are that they are not happy at losing their employment by the NHS and now are to work for a private company. Our understanding is that they are all to receive training before beginning their dispersion to work in new locations in West Harts and in shifts in which they had limited choice." A Harts Valley CCG spokeswoman said, "Cardiac rehabilitation services are not part of the contract awarded to Connect Physical Health Services." A Harts Valley CCG spokeswoman said, "Cardiac rehabilitation services are not part of the contract awarded to Connect Physical Health Centres. The contract will provide community support for patients needing help with musculoskeletal MSK rheumatology and pain, and will provide postural stability classes to patients in West Hertfordshire. Heartbeats will continue to provide level 4 cardiac rehabilitation services to patients to help maintain their health after recovering from a heart attack or heart surgery, and this service is unaffected by the forthcoming changes. Heartbeats will still have access to the gym at St Albans City Hospital Maple Unit to run their classes. All of the staff employed in the current service were consulted prior to them transferring to the new service, and eligible staff were able to transfer to the new provider under their current employment conditions. The new service is based in locations within West Hertfordshire and, where possible, will have been offered employment nearest to their home.
Fly-tipped rubbish. A Harpenden road was blocked when a pile of rubbish was strewn across the lane. Hearts police were called at about 7:30 p.m. on January the 8th to the pile of fly-tipped waste on Common Lane. They signposted the road and alerted Hearts County Council to the problem. There was a Christmas tree, a sofa, plant pots, tyres, plastic buckets and a table in the rubbish and mound. A witness, who asked to remain anonymous, said, "Personally, I find it appalling, not just because of the laziness of it, but because the cost of clearing it up, how unsightly it is, and also the damage to the environment and wildlife. Anyone with information should contact police on 101 or Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111.
A Ryder Cup star is heading to a St Albans golf club to raise money for Prostate Cancer UK. European Tour pro and Ryder Cup star David Howell will be coming to Verulam Golf Club on Saturday, March the 24th for a meet and greet and a three-course meal. The event has been organised by David Salter, who was part of the St Albans City Football Club team, which cycled to Amsterdam last year to support the charity. He said, "We're in a Ryder Cup year, so to have someone who's been victorious twice to headline our event at the home of the competition itself is a massive coup. It's for a great cause, and hopefully we can encourage as many people to support the event as possible."
Roofer steps in to offer free help at cat shelter. Darren Bell, 29, from King Harry Park in St Albans, stepped in to fix the cat house roof at Cat Welfare Luton after his partner saw their plea for help online. He said, "She pestered me to do it, as she thought it was a good idea." She donated the money for the materials. "It took 2.5 hours. It was a bit tricky, but my mate and I did it." Since Cat Welfare publicised his generous act, Darren said he has had a massive response from the public. "I've had so many responses. It's just been really good and everyone's really happy. I definitely feel good about doing it. Over the moon. You've just got to be nice these days. It was not much of a big job. And it's not just the money. It's about helping people." Darren, who runs Up and Over Roofing, has told the shelter he'll go back and fix other cat houses in need of repair, as long as they make us cups of coffee. Cat Welfare Luton are a home-based voluntary rescue which neuters feral cats and provides hand-rearing and critical care. Due to the nature of the cats, the vet bills are sizeable, so they rely solely on donations to keep going. Over the last few years, they've built up support through their Facebook page and an Amazon wish list. Cat Welfare Luton helped around 250 cats every year. The majority of these are feral and street cats. Founder Sally Ainsbury said, "We're immensely grateful to Hannah and Darren from Up and Under Roofing for spotting our appeal for help and volunteering the time and supplies. We could never have afforded to get the roof repaired and ultimately would have had to stop using the cat house, meaning we could help 50% fewer cats per year. The roof had been leaking for several months and was getting progressively worse. Darren and his workmate were friendly and professional and have done a perfect job. We would highly recommend them to anyone needing roofing work done."
Redbourne to feature in Channel 4 show. Redbourne has been shortlisted in a national competition to be crowned Village of the Year. The Village of the Year competition airs on Channel 4 and sees Penelope Keith travel around the UK with a team of three judges to find Britain's best village. As well as the title, the winning village will receive £10,000. Penelope's team of judges includes archaeologist and village historian Alex Langlands, garden designer Juliet Sargent, and fashion designer and Great British Sewing Bee presenter Patrick Grant. Together, they will explore villages and soak up local architecture, rural pastimes, and forgotten traditions and skills, culminating in a grand finale revealing the overall winner. While in Redbourne, Juliet will break bread with the local miller. The episode also features the village of Findon, Roe Hedge in Essex, and Coxheath in Kent. Redbourne Parish Councillor Ivan Hickmott, who put together the application for the show, said the TV company made two visits and met a number of people and saw some of our historical sites. I'm delighted that they shortlisted us, and said on the basis of their second visit that we'd have our 10 to 15 minutes of fame. We are absolutely thrilled. They met with me and had a trip to Redbournbury Mill, and they met the local miller who talked them through the baking process, which was fantastic. In terms of marketing the village, which is something we're trying to give more attention to, this is ideal. During the show, the judges will meet quirky characters that make up British life, seeing everything from scarecrow championships to Second World War festivals, aiming to capture all that is great about rural communities. The show airs every day on Channel 4 at 3 p.m, with a peak show every Saturday at 8 p.m. During the peak show, five villages from the week's heats will go head-to-head for a spot in the grand final. The finale will air on Saturday, February the 10th at 8 p.m. The Redbourne episode will air at 3 p.m. on Thursday, January 25.
Here's a couple of dates for your diary. Burns Night. A Burns Night supper is being held towards the end of the month at Fleetville Community Centre. The Friends of Fleetville Community Centre are holding the supper at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, January the 26th at the centre in Royal Road. The three-course haggis supper with live music, poetry and dancing is part of a series of events to raise funds for a new community centre building. Liz Bloom, one of the Friends of the Centre, said, "We're holding a variety of social events to fundraise throughout the year, and Burns Night is the first in 2018. Our vibrant and well-used centre is well overdue for replacement, having been built in the 1940s as a nursery for the children of local munitions workers. Attendance can be pre-booked at the Fleetville Community Centre, and guests can book a table for up to 8 people. Tickets cost £15 per person, and guests must bring their own drinks. Holocaust Memorial Day. A service to commemorate victims of the Holocaust and other genocides is being held in St Albans on Saturday, January the 27th. Residents are invited to join District Mayor Mohammed Iqbal Zia and watch the memorial candles be lit. Councillor Zia said, "Holocaust Memorial Day is a time to remember the victims of the Holocaust as well as subsequent genocides around the world. Kim Stern will talk about the 732 child survivors, known as the Boys, who were rehomed in various countries after the Second World War. Sophie Shad will talk about her short film, Kitty's Fortune, about the first night a local woman spent in Auschwitz. Everyone's asked to bring a button for a project aiming to collect 1.5 million buttons, one for each child killed in the Holocaust."
That's the final news item for today's programme. Now, a few ideas for programmes on national radio that you might find interesting over the next week. On Saturday the 20th of January at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4, Saturday Review host Tom Sutcliffe discusses, amongst other things, a production of All's Well That Ends Well and Steven Spielberg's new film, The Post. This is followed by Archive on 4, The Medium is the Message at 8 p.m. Douglas Coupland explores the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, whose visions of the evolution of mass media seemingly presaged the rise of everything from social media to virtual reality. Then on Classic FM at 9 p.m. in The Sound of Music, Howard Goodall and Andrew Lloyd Webber continue a celebration of musical theatre. On Sunday, the 21st of January, at 1:30 p.m. on Radio 4, James Naughty reviews the Trump presidency so far in Is Trump Remaking America? And tries to make sense of it all so far. If you want your year on Trump assessment to come with more laughs, the place for it is Rich Hall's US Breakdown at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4. At 4:30 p.m. also on Radio 4 is a new series of Poetry Please with Roger McGough, joined by Radio 4 poet in residence Alice Oswald. To round off the evening on Classic FM at 9 p.m, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Classical Music has Catherine Bott marking the 77th birthday of baritone and conductor Plácido Domingo by revisiting the careers of musicians known for excelling in more than one musical skill.
And a look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. At 9:45 a.m. each day on Radio 4 FM, Book of the Week, Reading Europe, Gert Max in Europe. Nicholas Farrell reads from the travelogue in which Dutch journalist Gert Max reported on the history of the 20th century in Europe from the places where its major events happened. At 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4, the 15-minute drama is The Truth About Hawaii, running for 10 episodes during this week and next week. This is a playful drama by Oliver Emmanuel, set in a near future, in which doctors can no longer prescribe antibiotics. On Radio 3 at midday, the composer of the week is Witold Lutosławski, whose extraordinary life mirrored the turbulent history of his homeland, Poland, through the 20th century. At 12:04 p.m. each day on Radio 4, in 2000 Years of Puzzling, Chris Maslanka, Puzzle Master General, traces our relationship with these cerebral quests and divides each episode into 5 key areas of puzzles, joined by specialists in each field. Also on Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. each day in a new series, Sweetness and Desire, A Short History of Sugar, food writer B. Wilson explores the complex story of our relationship with sugar. The essay, Forgetting, on Radio 3 has a series of talks running all week at 10:45 p.m. on different aspects of the pleasures and pains of memory. So don't forget to listen to that one. Book at Bedtime this week is also running for 10 episodes. Reading Europe, Turkey, The Red-Haired Woman by Orhan Pamuk is at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Sem Selik does not see much of his absent father and takes a job minding an orchard for his uncle. But a meeting with a well digger takes his life in a new direction.
And now some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday, 22nd of January at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, Start the Week, The Power of Art, Andrew Marr is joined by Andrew Graham Dixon and others to discuss this medium. At 6:30 p.m, the hosts of The Museum of Curiosity are joined by comedian Stephen K. Amos, nanochemist Suze Kundu, and author Victoria Hislop, who are asked to donate exhibits to their imaginary museum. On Tuesday, 23rd January, Olympic rower Helen Glover concludes her series on life after retirement from top-level sport by talking to multiple medal-winning athlete Chris Akabusi. That's 1:1 at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. The Radio 4 2:15 drama How Success Ruined Me is their pick of the day. Christopher Green and Roy Hudd tell the story of Fred Barnes, a gay icon and outrageous music hall star who topped the national circuit in 1911, performing with a pet marmoset on his shoulder. On Wednesday, 24th of January, on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, Free Thinking presents Royalty, Art and Patronage. Philip Dodd looks at power and patronage through the ages and changing depictions of royalty. At 8:45 p.m, still on Radio 4, Forethought tells the story of entrepreneur Vijay Mulenga, who shares his vision for helping young people overcome barriers to achieve their dream jobs. And staying with Radio 4 at 11 p.m, Tez Talks, Tez Ilyas returns in a new series of satirical comedy based on society's attitudes to Islam. As a taster, he tells his audience, the only difference between white working class and Asian working class is that one of us loves chicken tikka masala and the other one is Asian.
On Thursday, 25th of January at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Kate Adey introduced reports from correspondents around the world in a new series of From Our Own Correspondent. At 4 p.m. on Radio 4, in The Film Programme, actress and director Julie Delpy talks about why she thinks there are still so few female directors and why, in her experience, some male producers believe that women are too emotional to be in charge of film production. This is repeated on Sunday at 11 p.m. Radio 3's In Concert at 7:30 p.m. showcases Joshua Bell, the exuberant American violinist and director of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, who is both conductor and soloist in tonight's, in a programme which includes Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. Finally, for Friday the 26th of January at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 FM, neuroscientist Vincent Walsh tries to determine where the ideas of cartoonist Gerald Scarfe came from, examining the theory that two areas of his brain may be talking to each other in an unexpected way. That's Inside the Brain of Gerald Scarfe. Following that, at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4, in a new series of four episodes, All Those Women is a comedy by Catherine Jakeway about four generations of women living under one roof. Well, those are a few suggestions for programmes of various sorts over the next week. Whatever you choose, good listening.
Well, thanks to our readers for those radio listings and also, of course, for the news stories before that. I'll just give you the names of those whose deaths are announced in the Hearts Advertiser this week before we move into some music and then into the rest of today's programme. Alan Dickey, aged 96. The Reverend Father Thomas Hewitt, MSC. Now, he served the parish and community of St. Alban and Stephen for about 17 years, so he'll be well known locally. He died at the age of 71. Neil Douglas Clements, also well known locally as a long-serving member of the Wheat Hampstead Council, he died at the age of 77. Stan Baxter, aged 96. Myrtle Powell, aged 104. Antonino Del Core, aged 79. Glynis Husband, aged 64. William George Minnie, known as Bill, aged 95. Marjorie Pike, aged 85. James Michael Hennebry. Joseph Murta Vincent Lynch, aged 93. David Aubrey, aged 86. Kath Southern, aged 97. Norman John Powsland.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only.
I'm delighted to welcome Terry Prince into the studio again, and he's going to help us to understand one of Dickens' most interesting works, and we've just heard the beginnings of it there. It's a wonderful piece, isn't it?
Absolutely, and how relevant. I mean, it resonates today, does it not, in terms of the UK's relationship to France and Europe in general, the best of times, the worst of times. So some people will think it's the best of times, and some will think it's the worst of times.
Well, we better not go too far down that route.
No, we better not.
Because we're talking about A Tale of Two Cities.
We are.
By the time Dickens wrote this one, he was well established, he was quite well known.
Absolutely, yeah. Lionised. Everybody knew Dickens. The working man read Dickens. And his novels, as you know, were serialised, so people were queuing up to buy the next edition of the story. And I think that's what makes this a particularly exciting read, because you've got sort of the cliffhanger notion. You want to keep reading on and following the story through. Yes, he was well established by now, not just as a writer. Around about now, I think it's 1859 or so, 1860, he began his career as a public reader, where he read extracts from his novels to huge gatherings all over the UK, and he toured America on a couple of occasions as well. In fact, Dickens, I think, was an actor manqué. The story goes that had he not caught a cold on the day he was going to audition at a London theatre, he would have ended up as a professional actor. And his readings were tremendously theatrical readings. And I'm sure, and I know in fact, that Tale of Two Cities, extracts from those, featured in his readings.
Because it's about two countries, it's about England and France, at a very critical time, because we're leading up to the revolution in France and the concerns about the revolution in England. So we've got two sets of characters sets of situations.
We've got the two cities, the relatively peaceful and calm London, where Lucy Manette, and once she releases him from the Bastille, her father, Dr. Manet, live, and the banker. It's calm, it's peaceful, but the country is very aware of the revolution in France and the bloody aftermath of the revolution that's going on now. So you have this terrific contrast with the calm of London, contrasted with the violence and poverty, which produces more violence in a way. The people are very, very angry in Paris, in the suburbs of Paris.
Hunger. It was prevalent everywhere. Hunger was pushed out of the tall houses and the wretched clothing that hung upon poles and lines. Hunger was patched into them with straw and rag and wood and paper. Hunger was repeated in every fragment of the small modicum of firewood that the man sawed off. Hunger stared down from the smokeless chimneys and started up from the filthy street that had no offal among its refuse of anything to eat. Hunger was the inscription on the baker's shelves, written in every small loaf of his scanty stock of bad bread, at the sausage shop, in every dead dog preparation that was offered for sale. Hunger rattled its dry bones among the roasting chestnuts in the turned cylinder.
And there are some particular characters that Dickens explored in Paris.
Madame Defarge, who's hell-bent on gaining her revenge on the aristocratic family that carried out atrocities against her predecessors. And the member of that family she's particularly after, of course, is connected with the aforementioned Lucy Manette. So you have the love story there, which is in danger being destroyed by the actions of a bloodthirsty Madame Defarge, a woman to be feared.
I believe with all my soul that we shall see the triumph. But even if not, even if I knew certainly not, show me the neck of an aristocrat and tyrant, and still I would. Then Madame, with her teeth set, tied a very terrible knot indeed. Hold, cried Defarge, reddening a little as if he felt charged with cowardice. I too, my dear, will stop at nothing. Yes, but it is your weakness that you sometimes need to see your victim and your opportunity to sustain you. Sustain yourself without that. When the time comes, let loose a tiger and a devil, but wait for the time with the tiger and the devil chained, not shown, yet always ready.
I mentioned Madame Defarge. She's contrasted with Miss Pross, who is Lucy's confidant, etc. A terrifically powerful English lady. Think Margaret Rutherford. A nice comic relief as well, which is needed throughout the book. So you have the clash of these two women as one kind of storyline in the book.
Mrs. Pross is one of the characters, the typically Dickensian character in many ways, but there are others as well, and there's one that struck me.
Jerry Cruncher.
Mr. Cruncher reposed under a patchwork counterpane like a harlequin at home. At first, he slept heavily, but by degrees began to roll and surge in bed, until he rose above the surface with his spiky hair looking as if it must tear the sheets to ribbons, at which juncture he exclaimed in a voice of dire exasperation, "Bust me, if she ain't at it again!" A woman of orderly and industrious appearance rose from her knees in a corner with sufficient haste and trepidation to show that she was the person referred to. "What?" said Mr. Cruncher, looking out of bed for a boot. "You're at it again, are you?" After hailing the morn with this second salutation, he threw a boot at the woman as a third. It was a very muddy boot.
Very robust English character of the kind that Dickens was familiar with drawing.
So what Dickens is doing here is he's setting himself in a historical context, yeah, which is not typical of many of the other Dickens books that we know so well. I mean, you think of Great Expectations, the political context is not really well declared.
Now, off the top of my head, I can't think of another one that
That's right. So I think this is quite different in that sense, and yet he maintains the ability to construct characters. Yeah. And so, as you said, it's in series. You see, you get a bite-sized chunk each week if you're buying the paper, as it were.
That's right.
And in there, you keep the entertainment level going through these characters sometimes. They're not trivial characters. They're real. They've got a role to play, and they have a significant role to play in all of them in many ways. Mm-hmm. But it's also the cliff-edge stuff and the characterization.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it very entertaining.
Absolutely. His characters, I mean, even people who haven't read Dickens know of Dickensian characters. They know of Scrooge, they know of Oliver Twist.
Mr. Squeers.
They know Wackford Squeers. Yeah. Because they are so colourful, they're often accused of being larger than life with no kind of psychological depth. Now, I think there may well be some credence in that, but does it really matter in terms of the overall kind of shape of the story that he's telling? If you want psychological depth, you probably don't go to Dickens. But if you want well-drawn characters and a strong narrative, then you probably do go to Dickens.
Dickens is very difficult to read because it's quite dense,
yes,
and there are often sections that you think, crikey, I wish you'd get to the end of this and get back to the story. But of course, what he's doing is giving the colour and the context. And that's why listening to it is quite fun, because it takes you along with it. So you have the voice of the narrator to give you that extra access.
It's a narrator's joy, I think, to read a Dickens novel because you've got so many different characters to play with. I think your previous point is very well made, but I think the whole experience of reading then and now is very, very different. We live, I think, do we not, in an impatient age. We need to do something, get on to the next thing before we finish the first thing properly. So we have e-readers and we have smartphones to read from. And then life was slower paced, I would suggest, and you had time. I mean, what did you do in the evening if you didn't read? There wasn't a radio, there wasn't television, etc. And so he was able to indulge himself. I think that's a very fair
criticism.
But he
wasn't also, as you said yourself earlier, wasn't appealing to an elitist audience, because the common man could access.
There are many stories of common people breaking down in tears when they heard that Dickens had died. He was a friend to all of us. He was a man we could relate, and a man who related to us. Because he used to go on these midnight walks. He'd walk London, the streets of London, and because he had this actor's ability, had this actor's ear, he could put people on the page through their language alone. I mean, he's a master at doing this. Okay, so you don't get the psychological depth, perhaps, but you do get this string of colourful characters. So,
of course, Dickens knew his London very well. He'd had a pretty tough upbringing, hadn't he? I mean, he'd been in...
Very much so, yes.
His father's loss of money, he'd been in the debtor's prison.
His father ended up in the Marshalsea, and in one of his novels, Little Dorrit, explores the Marshalsea there. But the worst experience he had, which he writes about on many occasions, is when he was sent to a blacking factory to work on the edge of the Thames in a blacking factory. And he thought he deserved far better than this. And what really upset him was his mother colluded in this act. And when he eventually was able to get away from there, she was all for sending him back again. He had a very kind of rudimentary education, but he had above all an amazing energy. When you read anything about him, this is what impressed me more than anything else. The man was just a human dynamo. He never kind of stopped. I mean, he edited these monthly magazines. Before that, he was a journalist, churning stuff out. He was a law reporter, and then he became a novelist with his breakthrough novel, Pickwick Papers. And from then on, there was no looking back. It wasn't a wasted minute in his life. A man of tremendous energy. A man also who was the epitome of the English family man, the English heart. bath and all that kind of thing with the Christmas stories and what have you. Absolutely vile in his treatment of his wife.
Let's go back to the Tale of Two Cities, because that's where we came into this. Although the whole point is that there's so much in Dickens that anybody can explore, and listening to it, if not reading. Lucy, you mentioned the young girl whose father has come out of imprisonment and in a very shocking state.
In the Bastille, yes.
Very
awful.
But she has two or three or four potential lovers, people that fall in love with her.
That's right.
A couple of young men and some characters
that are
highly unsatisfactory. Yeah. But the two young men, one is fairly straightforward. He may have come from Paris. He has a background, which we could talk about.
Charles Darnay has a background indeed, and it's the very background that involves him with, or gets Madame Defarge involved with him. It's an aristocratic background that he comes from, and he falls in love with Lucy, and the implications of that involve another man who, had he thought more highly of himself, would have considered himself a suitor to Lucy, and that's Sidney Carton.
For you and for any dear to you, I would do anything. If my career were of that better kind that there was any opportunity or capacity of sacrifice in it, I would embrace any sacrifice for you and for those dear to you.
But as Sidney says of himself, I care for no man on earth and no man on earth cares for me. He's an outsider, a maverick, no kind of self-respect whatsoever. And yet he makes a moral journey throughout this book of an immense distance.
He's not seen that often in the story, is he?
No, because the main story is that about the machinations of Madame Defarge and the fellow revolutionaries to exact their revenge on anybody who's left from the aristocratic Evremont family. And of course, Lucy's father, unbeknownst to her, was imprisoned as a result of machinations by an aristocratic family to prevent him speaking the truth about an event that happened early on in his life, and he was thrown into the Bastille for that. So there's this constant intertwining of the two cities, London and Paris, through the characters involved. Lucy, Darnay, Carton, Defarge on the French side, etc. That this is a novel which moves at a great pace. He can be very, very wordy. This one rattles along, I think, anyway. I mean, he knocked it off in a year, which was some going, really. If you listen to this, I'm sure you'll be swept along because of the depth of feeling of the characters for each other and the sheer excitement of a tale, and the fact that, you know, we all have a knowledge, no matter how deep, we all have a knowledge of the French Revolution and the atrocities that were carried out there.
The grindstone had a double handle, and turning at it madly were two men whose faces, as their long hair flapped back when the whirlings of the grindstone brought their faces up, were more horrible and cruel than the visages of the wildest savages in their most barbarous disguise. False eyebrows and false moustaches were stuck upon them, and their hideous countenances were all bloody and sweaty, and all awry with howling, and all staring and glaring with beastly excitement and want of sleep. As these ruffians turned and turned, their matted locks now flung forward over their eyes, now flung backward over their necks, some women held wine to their mouths that they might drink. And what with dropping blood, and what with dropping wine, and what with the stream of sparks struck out of the stone, all their wicked atmosphere seemed gore and fire. The eye could not detect one creature in the group free from the smear of blood.
That keeps you riveted to the story. So don't be put off by the fact that, oh, it's Dickens and it might be long-winded and go on forever. No, it rattles a lot.
Revolutions are bloodthirsty, so there's, you know, once the revolution's begun, the number of killings and attacks increases, and so it becomes very, very dangerous, and that comes into the essence of the story itself, of course, because our characters find themselves in the middle of that. One of the things that I remember you told me once was that you'd produced a version of this as a stage play. I can't imagine how that was done.
Well, we put it into one of our seasons at the Abbey Theatre 10 years ago or so, I suppose. I forget the name of the dramatist who turned it into a play. I believe it had its first performance at Greenwich Theatre, and we got the rights, secured the rights to do it on stage. It's what I've just said. It's a great narrative, and it drives its way through, and that made it a very attractive proposition for me to direct and put it on stage. And also it had a range of characters. So you had the aristocracy, and it had the poor people of Paris, thirsty for revenge, as well as hungry for food. So a nice large cast, all the key characters were there.
You had your romantic storyline
going through, and you had the Sidney Carton storyline going through, and it was, will they be caught, will they escape, will true love find satisfaction, or will the guillotine claim yet another victim? It was staged with a working guillotine. How can that be, I hear you cry? Did you have 24 actors for each character? Not at all. It was the most efficient thing I've ever seen. We got the idea from Greenwich. Our wonderful team of workmen constructed this thing, and all I can tell you is, sitting in the audience, you saw the victim put his head in the hole. You saw the guillotine axe above him. That roll of drums, the axe fell, and the head fell into the basket. Obviously not the real head. We couldn't afford that many actors, and we had no volunteers for those roles anyway. Every night that happened, there was a gasp from the audience. It was terrific. So it worked as a play, I think, because Dickens, for me, always has that element of a theatre man about him. He was a lover of theatre and, as I said before, could have been an actor himself, and in fact did set up his own little acting company, performed in various houses throughout the UK, including over at Nebworth. And I think there may even still be some Dickensian events at Nebworth. So it did adapt for the stage very well. Not the only Dickens we've done. We actually one of the few amateur companies to have ever tackled Nicholas Nickleby that the RSC did in the 90s. In the 80s. And we did both parts of that.
Dickens has transferred to film many times very successfully. So there's obviously that inherent drama in everything he does. And I think probably that you've said a lot about Dickens and why it's great to read this. And I think all we would say is give it a go.
Give it a go. An exciting story. And, I mean, without the guillotine, I still think resonates today. And you'll all know the final sentence when you hear it.
It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
We're grateful to Calibre Audio for providing a CD from which we're able to take these extracts. The recording of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens was read by Richard Pascoe, and the recording lasts for 14 hours. I'm delighted to welcome again Akhtar Zaman, who is president of the St. Albans Islamic Centre, who's been taking us through some of the core principles of Islam. And today we're going to look at
the Hajj or the pilgrimage.
This is an annual event, isn't it?
So let me start by giving you a bit of an introduction as to what it is. I mean, many people have heard of this Hajj or the pilgrimage. However, not many people know the history behind it and the importance of it. From the previous sessions we've had, I've been talking about the five pillars or the five tenets of Islam. So once you accept Islam, which is the first tenet, there are four others which become compulsory on you. Taking a pilgrimage or the Hajj is one of those. It's normally the fifth one. It's known as the fifth pillar. Our beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, always used to say, think of it as a tent, whereas the acceptance of the faith is your middle pillar, and then you've got four pillars around it. If any one of those is missing, you're going to have a lopsided tent. So in order to have the complete faith, then you have to adhere to the five pillars.
Yeah, I said it was an annual event, but you're not, as a Muslim, expected to go every year. I mean, are you talking about once in a lifetime or...?
It's compulsory to go once in a lifetime. If you can go at other times, then good for you. The reason for the visit is, one, for the remembrance of Allah, and secondly, to get His nearness and forgiveness. So again, if I take you back in history a little bit as to where all this started from. when Adam, peace be upon him, came to earth, he was actually in that area. He was taught how to ask for forgiveness. And there is a mountain there called Mountain of Mercy, which is where he used to cry and pray to his Lord and ask for forgiveness, which is near the Kaaba. He also actually laid...
The Kaaba is?
The Kaaba, it's the cube building that you see in most of the pictures. People circumambulate around it. And there's a reason for it, because they were taught to go around it 7 times and ask for forgiveness. So the foundations of the original building, the Kaaba, was laid by Adam. Then over time it perished a little bit, and then it was re-established by Abraham with his son Ishmael. So they built it, and it was out in the wilderness a little bit because, it was mountains and valleys. There was no greenery of any kind, and Abraham did ask the question, will people know it's here? We always hear this statement, well, you build it and people will come. This is exactly what the Lord said to him, that you go ahead and build it, then it's my responsibility to ensure the message goes out.
What did he actually build?
He built a place of worship. It's basically a square building, and basically it's a focal point. And we believe that actually there is a stone in there which used to be white at one time, and over time it's actually become black. And a lot of people would like to go and touch it and kiss it when they are there as well. But it's actually no more than a focal point, a house of God, as we like to call it. And it's the building that we face towards no matter where we are in the world. When we do our 5-time daily prayer, we stand up and we face in that direction. So from St. Albans, it's actually 119 degrees.
Okay. Yes. You all carry a compass.
Yes, some people do. And I have it on my mobile phone. So.
And this is in the city of Mecca.
It is. Yes.
Has it always been
there? It has always been there. Okay. The city of Mecca has quite a significance because our beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was born there. So it's his city of birth. And of course, that's where the foundations of Islam started from. Although when he migrated to another city, Yathrib as it was called at the time, Medina as it is now, where he was invited by the inhabitants there to come and provide impartiality and governance, because he was known as being the truthful, the honest, etc. So having a number of tribes there that were always in conflict, they invited him in and said, could you actually help us with this? And he drew up the first constitutional charter of law for them in Medina. But Mecca is the main city. We have two main mosques. They're known as the Haramain. And the first one is in Mecca and the second one in Medina.
Go back now to the individual aspect of this. An individual, a Muslim, will make, let's say, that once in their lifetime, this pilgrimage. And that means physically travelling to Mecca. Is that where they all go? Do they start somewhere else and come towards Mecca?
And
when as well? Is it always?
Right. Yes, there is a specific time. And again, it goes on the Islamic calendar. There is a month called Dhul-Hijjah, which is the month of the Hajj, which is the 12th month of the Islamic calendar. It is at a particular time. However, when we go again by the Gregorian calendar, it moves 10 days early, around 10 days early each year.
Because there are how many months in the...
There are 12 months.
There are 12 months.
But the month duration or length is 29 or 30 days as opposed to 30 or 31 days.
Okay. But Hajj is usually after Ramadan?
Yes, it is.
Always after.
It's about 2.5 months after Ramadan.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Ramadan is in the 9th month and Hajj is in the 12th month.
The time is known, the place is known, and how does one go about it? Because one sees pictures of an enormous number of people there.
Yes, we're talking about several million people all congregating in that area at the same time.
For one day or for
it's several days. People normally go for about 3 weeks, but the compulsory or the obligatory tasks are normally carried out within 3 to 4 days. So people normally go early and they perform what's called the small Hajj or the Umrah first. They wear same clothes. So it's all about equality, whether you're rich, poor, black, white, it doesn't matter. There you're all equal. in the eyes of the Lord, and all the men wear two white sheets as a covering, and basically you carry out certain tasks which some of the previous prophets or people related to the prophets carried out. If I could give you an example, I talked about circumambulating around the cube building. Yes, that was done by previous prophets, done by Abraham and his son Ishmael, and also by our prophet. So we also do that, asking for forgiveness. The second part to that is running across two mountains called Safa and Marwa. The reason we do that goes back to the time of Hagar, the wife of Prophet Abraham. When he left them there in the valley, there was no water, no food. So they just had a handful of dates and the water ran out very quickly. And with a young child who was crying at the, you know, and almost at the at death's door because of hunger and thirst, she started to run between these two mountains, looking for water, and also to see if there were any nomads or travellers who might be going past and so on. So she actually ran between them seven times. So we, as part of the Hajj, also do that. This is compulsory.
What distance are we talking about here?
It's not that far, probably 150 metres between the two. But at her time, it was literally two mountains. Now it's actually a flat surface at the peaks of the mountain, so they've actually built between it, so it's actually easy to walk. You can even go in a wheelchair if you're invalid or, you know, infirm in some way.
And you've done the Hajj yourself?
I have. I went the first time back in 2001. There's three basic requirements when you go for Hajj. One, you must be healthy. You must be able to afford it from legitimate earnings, and you carry it out at the prescribed time. So it's basically, as long as you can do that and you carry out the obligation, you can go as often as you like. I've done several smaller Hajjs, or the Umrah, since then. I've done six or seven, because that's a lot easier to do. There's no prescribed time for that. You can go and do that at any time, whereas the Hajj is at the fixed time.
And you've got millions of people there going for the bigger event, and they've got to be accommodated. They've got to find somewhere. They can't live in tents in the desert.
No, in the early days, that's the way it used to be. A lot of people used to go either by sea on ships or on foot. These days, you can fly in. It's a lot easier. And because it's been happening for so long, it's an annual event, the government has actually made it quite easy for you now to be able to do it. However, that's not to say it doesn't have problems. I think it was last year at the stoning of the devil or Satan, several people got crushed, because that is at a prescribed time. People have to be there. And unfortunately, instead of following instructions and doing their duty and moving on from there, some tried to come back on the same route. And of course, we've heard of the Liverpool tragedy, similar thing. There was such a crush. So many people perished because of that. And again, that duty that we carry out with the stoning was done by the Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, when he was asked to sacrifice his son. In Islam, that's Ishmael. And of course, as he was going to this place to do the sacrifice, along the way, the Satan or devil came to him and said, "What are you doing? This is your one and only son." And in order to get rid of him, he picked up some pebbles and threw them. And of course, this is an act that we now follow in his steps. So he did that three times, and we also do that three times.
Take us through the sequence then. Mm-hmm. The small Hajj you can do either independently or prior to other steps. I mean, how many activities? You've talked about going around seven times. Yep. You've talked about stoning three times. Mm-hmm. How many stages are there?
There are some fixed acts that you have to do, and beyond that, you can do whatever you need to or want to do. So the first thing is you've got to have the intention. You can't just turn up and say, "I'm doing it now." No, you have to intend that that's what you're going for. So intention is very important. And you ask for help and guidance once you've made the intention. Secondly, as a male, you have to wear the two sheets that I mentioned. And they are not sewn in any way. that there's no sewing or fastenings. Basically, it's just two sheets that you put on. Thirdly, once you get there, you perform the small Hajj part anyway, the Umrah, which is to go around the Kaaba seven times. It's known as Tawaf. And also you have to go between the two mountains, Safa and Marwa, which is known as Sa'i. And then once you've done that, you can actually change into your normal clothing after that. Some people prefer to stay in the sheets known as the Ihram, but others change back into normal clothing. Then they basically go and visit these two places called Muzalfa and Mina. Mina is where Abraham went to do the sacrifice and the child was replaced with a ram. So then, you know, you go and do the stoning. So that's compulsory. So that's done at a fixed time on 3 days. And then beyond that, of course, you know, because the Prophet settled in the city of Medina, people like to visit that and at least perform a certain number of prayers there. So normally we talk about 40 prayers there. So people like to spend somewhere around 2 weeks in Mecca, 2 weeks in Medina. And then from a historical perspective, people like to go and see some of the historical sites as well, i.e. the cave where the Prophet got the first revelation of the prophethood and the Quran, some of the places where the battles took place and some of the companions died, etc. So they're all marked there, so you can go and see them.
So let's go back to the reason for all this. Mm. It's an instruction, it's an obligation.
Correct.
But what's it actually doing to the individual? What is it? What is
its aim? It's basically you are seeking the nearness of your Creator. You're asking for forgiveness because the ideal Hajj is that you come away with all your sins expunged, basically. Okay. Actually, one of the other acts is that at the end of the Mina or the Tawaf is you go and have your head either shaved or cut by a certain amount. And the reason for that is to say, well, okay, all my exterior sins are now gone. I'm actually starting a new life from here. And hopefully you become a better person beyond that.
Okay. And is that how people feel when they've been there? I mean, they're coming from all over the world and they're going to go back to all over the world. And
yes.
Do you sense that people are going feeling that they have established or re-established that relationship?
That link, yes, basically. If you come away feeling that you haven't done that, then clearly you need to look at yourself and see why you feel that. Is it because of you, the way you are, the way you feel, or was it because you were not able to carry out your duties? We always say that it's actually a calling from God, that He wants you to go. You know, you can prepare as much as you like, but if the calling isn't there from Him, then you're not going to go. I know it's not a nice thing to say, but I've heard of people who've prepared, who've gone there, got to the airport, but were not able to go for various reasons.
Because they themselves felt that it was wrong?
I don't know what their feeling is, to be honest, but they were not able to go and complete.
And they weren't stopped by any other human being.
No,
they could have carried on, but they stopped.
Yeah.
And they went back.
Yeah.
Okay, wasn't right somehow,
for
whatever reason.
Exactly.
Would you go with your son? Would you always go as an individual? Would you go as a family?
We like to go as a family and with friends, so as large a group as possible. Okay. But going with a family is fantastic if you can do that. It is a family occasion. It's very peaceful. Once you're there, you know, you forget the world somewhat and focus on your purpose of being. And it's very peaceful. I mean, I've sat in the mosque in Medina, which is known as the Prophet's Mosque. And in the evening, it's so peaceful. When you sit there, something happens and this calmness just descends on you. I remember the first time it happened, I came back to the hotel and said, "Did you feel anything?" And then they all went, "Yeah, we all did." It's actually, you know, seeking the forgiveness and the nearness of your Creator.
And by doing that as a family, that brings the family closer together?
It does.
So you're sharing.
It does.
I mean, you don't explore the sins, you don't discuss the sins, as it were.
That's
between you and your God.
Exactly. That's a bit of a private matter, and you don't need an intermediary because you have a mechanism where you can talk directly to the Creator, to your God, and ask for forgiveness. You don't have to go in talk or go through an intermediary or anything like that.
Is the Hajj carried out by all, I mean, primarily Sunni and Shia? Or is
Yes, it is.
So you will have in Mecca at the same time?
Yes.
You'll have Sunni and Shia Muslims coming together?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I have seen many, many Shias there when I visited myself. Interestingly, you can't tell the difference when you're all dressed in the same way. However, afterwards, when you see them in their own traditional dress, you can actually see the slight difference.
Tell me why, how? I wouldn't have the faintest
the
idea.
People, yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, the common man, probably not, but some of the more scholarly people, they in Shia traditions, they seem to wear this head dress, which is different to anybody else. You might have seen it on TV. As a Muslim, I can actually tell the difference, yes.
Very interesting. Next time we're going to look at some of the perhaps more difficult issues, the questions that come up when we all think about Islam. So thank you very much for today.
You're very welcome.
Well, thanks to everyone who's helped this week to read, produce, contribute and assist. Steve will be with you next week with his latest edition of News Extra. And I'll be back in a month's time with my next programme. Till then, wrap up warm, stay safe. Bye for now.